Welcome to If You Love This Planet. I'm Dr. Helen Caldicott, and in this program we talk about the greatest medical and environmental threats to all life, such as nuclear weapons and nuclear power, global warming, ozone depletion, toxic pollution, deforestation, and many other social and political issues that relate to global well-being. So if you love this planet, keep listening. Hello and welcome to If You Love This Planet. Today I'm speaking with Diane Curran, a partner in the law firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg and Eisenberg in Washington, D.C. Since 1981, Diane has represented citizen groups, state and local governments and individuals in a wide range of licensing and enforcement cases relating to nuclear power plants, factories and waste storage and disposal sites. In her 30 years as an environmental lawyer, Diane has raised safety and environmental concerns in many Nuclear Regulatory Commission cases. In the aftermath of September the 11th attacks, Diane's work has increasingly focused on security issues. In 2006, on behalf of the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace, Diane won a groundbreaking U.S. Court of Appeals decision requiring the NRC to consider the environmental impacts of intentional attacks on a proposed spent fuel storage facility. After the case was sent back to the NRC, the agency did a very poor job of addressing the issues in an environmental assessment. Thus, Diane and the organization she represents, Mothers for Peace, are back in court. Diane is now preparing for an oral argument in San Francisco. Diane Curran, welcome to If You Love This Planet.
Thank you very much.
Now, I'm really curious. You've been in this since 1981. That's a long time. That's 30 years. How did you get involved in the first place, Diane?
Well, I remember when I got out of college and I was living in Washington, I remember that there was controversy about the Seabrook nuclear plant. And I started paying attention to that.
Yeah.
And then I was in law school, and I was actually on a camping trip with my fiancé. And this was 1979, and while we were out in the mountains in West Virginia, the Three Mile Island accident happened. And I got back to town, and, of course, that was just a real crisis of confidence in nuclear power. I was looking for a job as a law clerk, and I went to work at this law firm called Harmon and Weiss, which was representing the Union of Concerned Scientists in the restart case for Three Mile Island. And I got very interested in the issues and just kept going. I stayed at the firm, and the first case I worked on was the Seabrook case, ironically, which I worked on for about 10 years. They tend to last a long time.
Oh, yes. I remember the first march on a cold spring April day in New Hampshire to the Seabrook site, and it was just at that time a rubbish dump. And I remember I stood on the rubbish dump with a megaphone and talked about the medical effects of plutonium. And, you know, there was a huge movement against Seabrook, and the Clamshell Alliance started because of them. And that they went ahead and built the blasted things anyway, two of them. So for 10 years, what sort of case were you involved in against them, Diane Curran?
Well, the main issue at Seabrook, and this was in the 1980s, was that during the construction permit phase, you know, nuclear plant licensing is typically broken in, or used to be broken into two phases, construction and operation. And various members of the public and state officials had raised the concern that if a plant were built there, it could never be safely evacuated because the site of the plant was across a little bay from a barrier beach and then the ocean. And the barrier beach is just chock-a-block with hotels and beaches and people all summer long. So if ever there were an accident at the plant, all these people would have to evacuate on little narrow roads going across the marshes, past the plant and out to the west of the plant. And the NRC had said then, well, we wouldn't allow them to operate this thing if it wasn't safe. So the case that went on for 10 years was primarily about the safety of evacuating the site. And then in the end, the NRC basically gutted the emergency planning rules that had been passed in response to Three Mile Island so that they could license the plant.
Well, what were the safety rules? I mean, I've been there, and I know there are thousands and thousands of people on that beach in the summer. It's just absolutely ridiculous. So what were the safety rules that they enacted after Three Mile Island, the accident, that they then gutted?
Well, the regulation required a demonstration that evacuation can and will be conducted safely in the event of an accident, or words to that effect. And what happened was the NRC, the first thing they did was when the state of Massachusetts refused to do their own emergency plan because they didn't want to go along with the charade, the NRC allowed Public Service Company of New Hampshire to do a plan for evacuating the seacoast that the state would implement. And so the state never bought into the emergency planning process, and the NRC said, well, we're just going to assume you'll implement it. And then when it came to looking at the actual doses that people would get during an accident and, you know, whether the evacuation could be done safely, there were a lot of assumptions made about sheltering in place and things like that that really just undercut the fact that you could not get people out of there safely. So it was a real lesson for me. And
a lesson about what?
Well, the regulatory process, how it really can fail unless the public is very vigilant over the process, because there is a lot of pressure. Once these reactors get going, the project gets going, there's a lot of pressure to go ahead and license them.
Well, it's corrupt. And the whole thing's corrupt, isn't it? I mean,
Yeah. Let's
be frank. If there's a meltdown like at Three Mile Island or Chernobyl, nobody knows for a while. The people at the plant are so anxious and confused, not knowing what's happening, they don't tell anyone for a while, especially the officials. And by the time that there is an announcement, the radioactive cloud has passed over all the people on the beach and they've all been severely irradiated, so much so that probably most of them would die within a week or two with their hair falling out, vomiting and bleeding to death. And then not only does the cloud pass over that beach, but it could move. I mean, Three Mile Island, which was in Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, the radiation reached all the way up to Boston. So we look at Chernobyl and the radiation totally covered Europe. So, I mean, it's fallacious. Fallacious is the word to talk about evacuation plans in the first place. I mean, the very basic principles that they act upon are fallacious. It's like a card house, right?
Well, it is difficult to see how you could, in most places, evacuate safely. There's usually some serious problem that, you know, goes with the site.
Yeah, but what my point was, Diane Curran, that you, by the time the evacuation order is signed or sealed, it's too late because the people have already been irradiated, you see? So and having sirens at the plant, you know, that go off. I, in my book, Nuclear Power is Not the Answer to Global Warming, described a report from the Union of Concerned Scientists about a meltdown at Indian Point. And people would be trapped in their cars. They'd be trapped in gridlock traffic. They'd be irradiated in their cars. If they got out of the car, they'd get more irradiation than if they stayed in the car. How do they get their children from the kindergartens, their spouses from the work, their old mothers and fathers? I mean, the whole thing is just an absolute farce. And what worries me, I suppose, having been involved in this area for as long as you, or maybe a little longer, is that the notion is that all the principles are based on lies, I think. That's what I'd say, on lies. Assuming there's an assumption that people can be evacuated, and the truth is they can't. They can't.
Yeah.
So yeah. You must get terribly frustrated, Diane Curran, as a lawyer, to, you know, have to assume that these principles are accurate and correct when in truth they're not. I mean, is there any way to challenge these principles upon which the laws are based?
Well, yeah, it's very difficult to challenge the regulations that they come up with. You can do it. But I guess, you know, from my perspective, the neighbors of these facilities don't have a lot of choice when one of a facility is proposed or operating in their neighborhood, but to engage in the process, because, you know, it's a way of at least improving the safety of the operation. I've really noticed that if the neighbors are vigilant over the facility, it does get more attention from the regulators. It's just a basic human characteristic, I guess. And it seems to me to be very important.
Well, I'm sure that's right, but then we come down to basic human behavior, and the behavior of very complex systems are designed by man, and to know that always faults can occur in complex systems. For instance, the space shuttle that exploded was because there was an O-ring made of rubber that at the very cold temperatures at Cape Canaveral that morning, the O-ring froze, and they didn't really compute that in their calculations, and hence lives were lost in a very, very complex system. And so I suppose, coming from the perspective that I do as a physician, knowing the abnormalities and frailties in human behaviour, plus the systems they design, that we're sort of battling uphill to make an unsafe, basically unsafe and intrinsically unsafe system safe.
I totally agree with you. And it's only gotten worse in the last 10 years. I'm very concerned that the level of secrecy which the government now requires over the operation of nuclear facilities is so extreme in comparison to how it was before September 11th that it's now very difficult for people who live near these facilities or for scientists who are critics of the facilities to get the kind of information that they would need in order to make a meaningful criticism of what's going on.
Well,
for instance, yeah. You know, when they had that, I think it was in 2006, NFS, Nuclear Fuel Services in Tennessee, had a spill of highly enriched uranium. And that was kept a secret for over a year until finally one of the commissioners, Commissioner Yasko of the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, said, this isn't the kind of thing that's supposed to be a secret. This is just embarrassing information. But the idea that it would be kept secret from the public, that a licensee responsible for the most dangerous material in the world could not take care of it. You know, highly enriched uranium can be used to make a bomb very easily. It's just astounding.
What was the spill, Diane, of highly enriched uranium? How did it happen, and what areas were affected, and who was managing the facility?
I really don't know the details. All I know is that my understanding of how it was discovered was someone was walking down a hallway and saw a puddle of a yellow puddle of liquid leaking out from under a door or something. And lo and behold, it was high-enriched uranium that had leaked out of whatever container it was in, and it, you know, leaked out of into the hallway or something. And the shape of the puddle, had it been different, could have caused a criticality accident, you know, runaway chain reaction. So, you know, pretty pretty dangerous things going on and kept a secret, not because really it needed to be, but because it was embarrassing.
Well, who kept it a secret? Did the government keep it a secret?
Yeah, the government kept it. The Navy asked the NRC to keep it a secret. And I think because of this one commissioner, it finally came to light. But if he hadn't noticed this piece of information buried and brought it to light, you know, probably never would have come to light.
Yeah, I like that guy, Yasko, in the Nuclear Regulatory Commission. Isn't he now the chief of the NRC?
He's the chairman of the commission.
Yeah, I think he's an excellent man with integrity. I had him at one of my symposia in the past, and I liked him very much. Tell us about how and why these issues about all things nuclear have become so secret since 9/11, Diane Curran.
Nuclear facilities are attractive targets for anybody who wants to do harm, because if you attack them, you can cause a lot of damage, you can cause a lot of fear, you can cause damage that's very expensive, very widespread. So there's other, you know, big facilities like bridges and things like that would be considered attractive targets. And the NRC does not want to put information into the public domain that could be used by people who would attack these facilities to do harm. But the trouble with that is that if nobody has information about the designs of these facilities, then it's not possible to criticize the designs from the standpoint of making them safer or resolving problems that are overlooked. And a really good example of that is spent fuel pools, where spent fuel from nuclear reactors is stored at every single reactor in the country.
How many reactors are there?
There's a little over 100.
Yeah, go on.
And each one has a pool.
A pool.
And a pool with filled with water.
Yeah.
And it's filled with the used reactor fuel that needs to be ultimately disposed of. And, of course, there isn't any place to put it yet.
Which is highly, highly radioactive.
Very radioactive.
When you put uranium in a reactor, it becomes 1 billion times more radioactive than the original uranium after the fission process. So that's the stuff that they call spent fuel, radioactive fuel. Yeah, go on.
And it's got a different characteristic than the fuel that's fresh inside the reactor, in that it's got a lot of cesium in it. And cesium, if it goes into the environment, it doesn't kill you right away, but it contaminates the environment. You have to relocate people. And for instance, my understanding is that the main radioactive component from the Chernobyl accident was cesium, which went far and wide. They had to kill reindeer herds and Lapland. It's a very serious contaminant. So that is the main constituent in the spent fuel. Because way back when Gerald Ford and Jimmy Carter were president, they both canceled the reprocessing program in the United States because they thought reprocessing was too vulnerable to theft of plutonium and proliferation of nuclear weapons. They didn't want...
So wait a minute, Diane. You have to explain the process of reprocessing so people are on the same page as are you.
Okay. Yeah. Well, you take spent fuel and you take the fissile uranium out of it and you process it into nuclear plant fuel again. But there's also a lot of waste there, and there's one of the things that is created when fuel is burnt in a reactor is plutonium. So you have to take out the plutonium. And in some cases, they use the plutonium in the new fuel, but it has to be separated out from the spent fuel. So that's the reason why Carter and Ford canceled the reprocessing program. And therefore, the fuel, spent fuel, had to be stored in pools. Originally, when the nuclear industry was very young, the pools had very little spent fuel in them. So the racks that were used were low-density racks. They were basically like the racks in an old-fashioned milk box on your back porch, open metal racks. But as the amount of spent fuel increased over the years, licensees had to do something to allow them to be packed closer and closer together. So they had to put more and more boron in the water to prevent a runaway criticality reaction. And eventually, the industry came up with a design that involved constructing sleeves, vertical sleeves, where each assembly would be put into a sleeve. And the sleeve was metal, and it was impregnated with boron. Each sleeve had holes in the bottom and holes in the top so that the water would go in the bottom holes, go up over the fuel assembly being heated as it went up, and come out the top holes. And then, of course, it would go through a heat exchanger and cool off, and then the water would just be circulated over and over again. And in the early days, the analyses that the NRC did of the risk of a fire assumed that the most severe case would be if the fuel was completely uncovered in, say, a catastrophic earthquake. All of a sudden, all the water is gone from the pool, and only air is circulating over the spent fuel assemblies. And the NRC analyzed that situation and said, only fresh fuel is going to burn under these circumstances, or relatively fresh fuel. If it's aged a couple years, you don't have to worry about it. And various scientists were saying, well, wait a minute, what if the cooling function is disrupted? What if air can't circulate over the spent fuel assemblies? What if there's half water in the bottom of the pool and air in the top of the pool, and so the bottom holes in these sleeves are covered with water and the top is covered with air? And the NRC just ignored that. But 25 years later, the NRC had to admit in that situation, the fuel would burn and you have a catastrophic fire. That was just about sometime in 2001 when, after 25 years of denying this, the NRC admitted it. And then September 11th happened, and most of the information relating to how the NRC has addressed this very, very serious problem has been taken off the public record and is now treated as classified information. So if you're a neighbor who's concerned about whether the licensee at your local nuclear plant has done a good job of reducing the risk of a catastrophic pool fire at your neighborhood nuclear plant, there's no way you can get enough information to satisfy yourself that's been done. And this is the situation for an agency that for 25 years ignored evidence that they had a serious problem. It doesn't build your confidence to know that now all this information is a secret, and no one can look at it besides the NRC and the industry, which has a vested interest in minimizing the cost of whatever measures are needed to make it safe.
Well, I'm speaking to Diane Curran, who's an attorney who for nearly 30 years has been struggling against the nuclear industry to try and make it honest. Diane, as you speak, I wonder how on earth we, you, me, everyone, can get this extremely important information out into the American public in general. And my experience is that the only way to do this is through the media, for instance. If you are on O'Reilly or any of those characters, you would have an audience of millions, and people would suddenly wake up and say, oh, my God, I live near Diablo Canyon. I live near Seabrook. I live near, Indian Point. And there could be awakened a huge sort of citizens' movement for safety for themselves and their children. Have you thought about that aspect? And as a lawyer or an attorney, Diane Curran, can you do that sort of thing?
Well, all of the groups that I work with are very serious about working with the press and trying to get their message out into the press. They're constantly working at that. So, and I know the Mothers for Peace really appreciated the opportunity they had to go on your radio show. And, you know, they're constantly sending out news releases about what's happening. I think it's really important to get these issues into the press. I agree with you. I think public information is very, very important.
Well, yes, and when you were talking about cesium all across Europe from the Chernobyl plant, you know, at the moment there are hundreds, thousands of wild boars running through Germany, pigs who are so full of cesium they have to be killed and disposed of in a special site. And that's only Germany. Cesium was deposited all over Europe and as far away as Wales in England. So things are pretty grim, and I think the listeners should know that in a nuclear power plant the size of Diablo Canyon, for instance, there's as much long-lived radiation as that released by 1,000 Hiroshima bombs. But in the fuel pools where the spent fuel is stored, there's 2 to 30 times more radiation in those pools than there is in the reactor itself. So in a certain sense, a meltdown in a fuel pool is by orders of magnitude more serious than in fact, you know, a Chernobyl-type explosion.
And, you know, the ironic thing is that this risk of a catastrophic fire in a fuel pool could be eliminated if the licensees, if the reactor owners went back to low-density fuel pool storage of fuel combined with dry storage. So take most of the fuel out of the pools and put it in dry cast storage on the site, which is it's a method of fuel storage that uses passive air cooling. And of course, you would want to use an adequately robust kind of storage container to prevent that from being vulnerable to an attack or an accident. But still, you would dramatically reduce the risk of these fires. And instead of doing that, the NRC is still allowing these licensees to use the high-density storage and doing who knows what, some kind of mitigation measures, they're saying, in order to reduce the risk. When you were talking, Helen, about public information, why not say to the public, we have eliminated this risk. If you want to attack this facility, don't bother. It's not a risk anymore. You cannot hurt it this way anymore. Why not do something that you can publicize and talk about with everybody instead of doing some half-baked thing and making it a secret?
Well, let's get to the root cause of the problem, Diane Curran. Isn't it that the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, which is a government body, federal government body, is in fact financially supported almost 100% by the nuclear industry itself. Is that not true?
Well, it is true that now there's the cost of regulation are passed through to the licensees. The taxpayers aren't paying for it. But, you know, I think there's something else that's going on. It's something that you see in every regulatory agency where the agency becomes a captive of the industry that it's regulating, because the regulated industry has all the access, has the money, has the ability to lobby Congress, which really oversees the NRC and is giving it instruction, so that there's a tremendous amount of pressure from the regulated industry on the agency. And the public, which does not have those kinds of resources, doesn't have access to the information, is a much weaker force.
Yes, well, that's what we see in Congress all the time, and particularly when we look at this current election. The money that's being poured in from unidentified sources, because the Supreme Court said they don't have to identify themselves now, is absolutely obscene. And the other thing that really worries me, Diane Curran, is that most politicians are scientifically illiterate. Look, they have really no idea about the dangers of radiation. And I remember when I used to go to Washington as quite a young woman in the late 70s and early 80s, and I'd meet a congressman going from his office to the Congress, and he'd say, "Who are you?" And I'd tell him, and I'd say, "I'm a doctor." And he'd say, "What are you here for?" And I'd say, "Well, I'm here to talk about the medical effects of nuclear power." And he would say, "Well, come and get me off the congressional floor this afternoon and talk to me about it." And I thought, "Oh, good." So I did. And I started telling him about genes and sperm and radiation and genetic abnormalities and cancer. And he'd say, "Do you know you've got very beautiful eyes?" Mm-hmm. And I thought, "Oh, my God." So I'd keep on with the sort of medical problems that I was so deeply concerned about, because I was treating children who were dying of cystic fibrosis at Harvard, and you know, that's an inherited disease that certainly will be increased by the radiation from nuclear power over time. And then he said, "Would you have a steak for dinner with me tonight?" And that's the sort of thing that I got fairly consistently, I have to say. And it was very clear to me that they had no idea about radiobiology or the pathogenesis of radiation or cancer and how it's caused, and nor did they care. And they didn't understand nuclear at all. So when these sort of scientists from on high descend and the red carpet rolls out in Congress and all the money's being doled out to the congresspeople from various sources, you know, they're confused, and there's a bit of idolatry going on, because they're sort of like the science, like Merlin, as they don't understand these scientific concepts, but they believe, quotes, the scientists. And therefore, we're being governed by people who, on the whole, have absolutely no idea of what we're talking about, in a way. Do you strike that in Washington, D.C., Diane Curran?
Well, you know, mostly I deal with the Nuclear Regulatory Commission, but I think, you know, you're raising a point that okay, you have a technology and it's used to generate electricity. That's the purpose. But it's extremely dangerous. It creates a waste product that no one knows how to dispose of. The technology is very complicated, and much of it that's important information is kept a secret. And here we are at a crossroads where we must do something to reduce our dependence on fossil fuels. We must change our whole electricity production scheme and approach. Why should we invest taxpayer dollars in supporting a technology that has so many disadvantages, so many risks, so many complexities, when there are other technologies that will accomplish the same thing with much fewer risks and that are easier to understand and that don't have to be kept a secret? I think it's an enormously important question.
And what do you think the answer to that question is, Diane?
Well, we should be investing our money in solar energy, geothermal, wind, research. The last president to do any significant amount of spending money on research into energy alternatives was Jimmy Carter. And we have a big catch-up game to play. But why, you know, the big push now that you see in Congress is money for nuclear power. And we just saw with Calvert Cliffs that where the government offered a loan guarantee in very generous terms, the company didn't want it because basically it didn't require the taxpayers to completely back the project. It actually wanted something from the stakeholders of the project. It's crazy to ask the taxpayers to pay for this kind of thing without offering us a choice of whether we would prefer to have something that is less dangerous and complicated and with less of a waste product.
Well, why do you think that the Congress and Senate taken with, in love with, in a way, nuclear-powered Diane Curran. What is it about it? Is it a particularly male attribute? What is it?
I don't know. I think the nuclear industry has a tremendous amount of money that they can spend on lobbyists to try to persuade Congress of their point of view. And I'm not sure the other energy technologies are as well supported.
Yes, and also let's not forget nuclear power, it's socialized electricity. Nuclear socialism, really, because as you've just pointed out, it's pretty well covered by the taxpayers.
Yeah, it's true. Well, we already subsidize it, right? If we didn't have the Price-Anderson Act,
describe that.
The Price-Anderson Act, which was passed a long time ago when the industry was in its infancy, is a law that limits the liability of the industry for a nuclear accident. I don't remember what the limit is, but once they pay up to that limit, the taxpayers take over the rest, because no company could get enough liability insurance for the kind of an accident a nuclear plant could cause. So we've been, we've been subsidizing the industry through that for a long time, through research and development grants. And now, of course, we have the loan guarantees for this new generation of new reactors.
Yes, well,
which right now stands at $18.5 billion, and there's a lot of proposals to increase it.
Yeah, I know. The other thing to note, too, of course, is that the nuclear industry is a prodigal son of the weapons industry, and the weapons industry, of course, is totally paid for. It's a socialized industry. They're socialized nuclear weapons, nuclear socialism, and so I think the nuclear power industry has just inherited that sort of philosophy, and it goes along really unimpeded. The other thing that really fascinates me, Diane Curran, is I suddenly realized the other day, well, I have known for a long time, Europe is absolutely covered with nuclear power plants. It's like it's peppered all over with nuclear power plants, as is the United States. Do you know what? That makes war obsolete. If the Second World War was fought today, Europe would be uninhabitable for the rest of time, because most of those reactors would have been attacked or lost their external electricity supply and melted down. And I don't think many people understand that. And the other thing is that one big hydrogen bomb exploded in space above the states could wipe out the power supply and eliminate 6 western states of the US. So that means that a huge electromagnetic pulse comes down and knocks out the electricity supply, which will then induce meltdowns, because all nuclear power plants need external electricity to continue to supply and circulate the cooling water in the reactor and the cooling pools. Those sort of things, I mean, a switch suddenly turned on in my head and I said, oh, my God, you know, we don't talk about these things.
Yeah.
You must be aware of them, are you?
Yeah.
Tell me about your work with Diablo Canyon and the Mothers. Is it the Mothers for Peace? Mothers.
Yeah, the San Luis Obispo Mothers for Peace.
Yes.
Which is a really quite amazing organization that started in the 1970s as a peace group, and then turned their attention to the Diablo Canyon nuclear plant when it was proposed there. It's an all-volunteer group. Mm. They don't have a single paid staff member, and they fought the construction permit, they fought the operating license, and when the plant was licensed, they set about to monitor the operation of the plant. They've participated in several hearings since the plant was licensed, and they're in the middle of a case now that started in 2002 involving a proposed dry spent fuel storage facility on the site that would take excess fuel from the fuel pools, and store it in these containers that are passively cooled by air. And dry storage, in comparison to pool storage, is a better way to store spent fuel, but it still has drawbacks. And one is that this particular facility was not designed to, it was to some degree designed to withstand an attack. But the NRC did not go through the full process of looking, as it would in an environmental impact statement, of looking at all a range of alternatives that they could have used to make this facility better protected from a terrorist attack than would generally be required by the NRC's ordinary security requirements. Basically, in an environmental impact statement, an agency is supposed to really look hard at new ways that it hasn't thought of before of protecting the environment from adverse effects. So the mothership piece was concerned that they couldn't see any evidence that either PG&E, Pacific Gas and Electric, or the NRC had taken into consideration things like putting these casks in a berm or sort of a bunker so that if someone flew a plane in to the site, and this site is sitting on a hillside overlooking the Pacific Ocean, that they couldn't do damage to the facility that way, or if they shot a weapon at it, they couldn't hit it. Mm. If scatter the casks over the site so they don't make one focused target. We didn't see any evidence that the NRC had done that. So we brought a lawsuit to try to get them to do it. And the NRC said, we don't have to do that. We don't have to comply with this environmental law if it has any relation to security issues. We took the NRC to court, and we won. The court said there's no exception for security issues.
Oh, that's great.
You're licensing this thing. You've got to do an environmental study.
Yeah.
So the NRC said, okay. And they went back, and they did a real quick job. They did something like a 10-page study and said, there's no impact from a terrorist attack on this facility. And we were astounded by that because it's very obvious that you could do significant environmental damage with one of these things if you could set the fuel on fire. Just like in a spent fuel pool, the really dangerous thing is that the cladding that surrounds the spent fuel assemblies is flammable.
Zirconium.
So, yeah, zirconium. So we asked, well, why didn't you look at the potential for setting a fire in one of these things? And they said, we're not going to talk about it with you. It's classified information. So we asked for a closed hearing, to which we are entitled under the Atomic Energy Act.
Mm-hmm.
And the NRC said, no, we only do closed hearings for other kinds of issues, but not this kind, not these environmental issues. So we're back in court, and we're trying to get a closed hearing where, even if we can't discuss all the issues publicly, at least we can have our technical experts look at what the NRC did and criticize it, because we think they've overlooked the most significant environmental risk that's posed by this facility.
Yes.
So that's where it's at. We have an oral argument November 4th. And we're looking forward to it.
Oh, well, I wish you luck. Is the spent fuel pool, Dan Curran, on the roof of Diablo Canyon?
No, it's not. I believe the spent fuel pools are in the ground.
Oh, because if they're on the roof, and many are, they're really open to terrorist attack. You know, one shoulder-held missile going to a spent fuel pool will drain the water out, yeah, and produce meltdown. Now, the other thing to think about, too, with Diablo Canyon is, and I love the name, Devil's Canyon. It's been found, well, there are two things, to be very, very close to a major earthquake fault, number one. Number two, as the oceans rise, as they are now doing because of global warming, there could be a rogue storm that could flood the control mechanism of Diablo Canyon and cause a meltdown. Have those two considerations are being taken into account by you people, by Mothers for Peace, by the NRC?
Well, that's interesting you should raise that, because recently PG&E applied for a 20 to 40-year renewal of its license.
How old is the plant already?
I think it started...
It's about 30 years
old. They're operating in the 80s.
Which is the sort of time that nuclear power plants are designed to operate before they close, yes.
Right.
Go on.
And they've applied quite a bit in advance, I think 14 years in advance of the expiration date of their license. And one reason why we're concerned that they've applied so far ahead of time is that only recently a new earthquake fault was discovered, and the fault runs right through the site.
Oh, my God.
It's called a shoreline fault.
Oh.
And PG&E and the United States Geological Survey are in the course of studying this fault.
Oh.
And the Mothers for Peace has gone into the NRC and requested a hearing on why this plant should get its license renewed before there's better information about this fault. So we're contesting the issuance of a renewed license because there isn't enough information that's known yet about what kind of a risk this fault poses, and to not just the plant, but the spent fuel pool. So we have that issue in, and we're looking forward to having a hearing on it.
Oh, my God, because I think there's thought that that fault, the shoreline fault, could be related in some way to the San Andreas fault, number one. Number two, you never know what sort of earthquake will occur with these faults. For instance, in Christchurch in New Zealand at the moment, they had a tremendously large earthquake, I think 8.5 on the Richter scale. And since then, since September 4th, they've had 2,044 aftershocks, many of them quite large, and it's just shaking and shaking and shaking the place to bits. So you can't predict what the earth is going to do, right?
Right. And the hard thing is, you know, nuclear plants, they're all designed to meet what's called the design basis earthquake, but that doesn't account for what happens if a really severe earthquake happens. And that's a more difficult thing to predict. And you want to have as much information as you can about that. But PG&E is rushing ahead with their license renewal application before they've got it.
What's the matter with these people? Are they insane?
Well, it does seem like they're playing roulette.
Oh, my God. If you lived in San Luis Obispo with the current problems with this reactor, which is not very far away, a few miles, would you stay there? If you had children, would you move? What would you do, Diane Curran?
Well, you know, that's such a hard question. And the thing is, I represent people who stayed. Mm. And one of the things that I admire about the Mothers for Peace is that they stay and fight. They feel it's their community, and they're going to fight for it. And they're not going to take assurances of, trust us, we'll take care of you. They want to know. And I think they really exemplify the kind of commitment that people need to have to where they live, to the earth.
Yeah.
You work for their communities.
Yeah, you work for them for free, don't you, for gratis?
Well, let's just say I donate a fair amount of my time. And it's all worth it.
Oh,
it's just a real honor to work for them.
Oh, Diane, it's wonderful. Now, you didn't answer my question about sea level rise. Has that been considered at any of the reactors that are placed at ocean level around the United States?
I would guess that it may have come up in some lower lying coastal areas, but I'm not really sure.
Well, the predictions are pretty vast. I've done a few radio programs on sea level rise, and like earthquakes, it's really unpredictable, but they're talking about 1 to 2 meters by the Yeah, by the end of the century. But that's not the only thing, you see, because there are going to be these catastrophic storms that we're already seeing. So together with the sea level rises and the catastrophic storms, it's quite possible that that this reactor could be flooded, number one, or a tsunami could occur because of the earthquakes off the coast of California just near Diablo Canyon.
Yeah. What? And, it, you know, if you look at how severe accidents happen at nuclear reactors, mm-hmm. it's often in the context of off-site power is lost,
mm-hmm.
and then systems go down, and then a series of things happen, mm-hmm. and then you get a severe accident. So if only for that reason, the additional storm activity is going to play a role in the risk of accidents at nuclear reactors.
Have you ever, Diane Curran, thought about writing a book about your experience? Because it's very fascinating, and you know more than most people will ever know about the lore and the intrigue and et cetera in the nuclear industry. Have you ever thought about doing that?
Yeah, I have thought about it. I just can't seem to find any time to do it. My job keeps me pretty busy, but one of these days I would love to write it down.
Yeah, I mean, you could even, it occurs to me, write an article for Huffington Post. That would take you a day or two, that's all. And that's widely read by a huge number of people now.
Yeah.
I think that would be a great contribution. Is there anything else we haven't covered that you would like to bring out now in this interview, Diane?
No, I really think that we have covered a lot of ground. And I really appreciate the opportunity to talk to you and to try to get the message out to the public how important it is to be aware, be educated, don't take trust us for an answer, and participate.
Do you have a website that people could go to learn more?
Well, Physicians for Social Responsibility has a great website on the nuclear renaissance. I'd recommend that.
Yeah.
And also the Mothers for Peace website has a lot of information about Diablo Canyon and nuclear energy in general.
Yes, and I've got a new website too, of a similar vein, called nuclearfreeplanet.org, with a huge amount of information. So the more the merrier. And I think that people can start twittering if they were inspired by your interview, and digging and blogging and the like, because that's one way that the new social media can impact people and educate people, and it's very useful.
Yeah, great idea.
Anyway, Diane Curran, thank you so much for the interview. It's been very educational for me, and I'm sure for the audience in general.
Well, thank you.
Okay.
Bye.
Today on If You Love This Planet, I've been speaking with Diane Curran, a partner in the law firm of Harmon, Curran, Spielberg and Eisenberg in Washington, D.C. Diane represents citizen groups, state and local governments and individuals in a wide range of licensing and enforcement cases relating to nuclear power plants, factories, nuclear waste storage and nuclear disposal sites.
In the spring, one sunny day, a good gal left me. Lord, she went away. She's gone home, but I don't worry, no, I'm sitting on top of the world. She called me up down in El Paso. Come on, Daddy, oh Lord, but I need you so. I'm sitting on top of the world. I'm going to India. Mississippi River, deep and wide. The woman I'm loving, oh, she's on the other side. She's gone home, but I don't worry, no, I'm sitting on top of the world. Don't like my peaches, don't you shake my trees. Get out of my orchard, oh, let those peaches be. She's gone home, but I don't worry, no, I'm sitting on top of the world.
That song was Sitting on Top of the World by Harry Manx. Thanks for listening. If you want to catch up on previous interviews, which cover some of the same topics, go to our website at ifyoulovethisplanet.org. And if you want to help to keep us on air, there's a place that you can contribute to that. Thanks for listening today, and we'll be with you next week.
You've been listening to If You Love This Planet with Dr. Helen Caldicott. This program is broadcast on community radio across the United States, including our host station, KPFT Pacifica, Houston, Texas. This program is produced and engineered by Jazz Williams, co-produced by Scott Powell, and our publicity and outreach are coordinated by Amanda Bellerby. To listen to previous shows or to make a donation, go to our website, ifyoulovethisplanet.org.